I'd like to introduce our speaker, Margaret McMillan, an eminent historian, emeritus professor of University of Oxford, and currently still working at University of Toronto, an author of many great books, including Peacemakers, and of course the new book, her new book, which is War, How Conflict Shapes Us. Ladies and gentlemen, Margaret McMillan.
Thank you very much, Hugh. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm so impressed with the way that all the staff and volunteers at Chalk Valley have adjusted to rapidly changing conditions. I mean, they would have all made great generals, I think, in wartime. The last time I was here, I think, was about 3 years ago, when the weather was very different, indeed. I remember talking in a tent and wondering if we were all going to be like something out of The Wizard of Oz, simply taken up and removed. It reminded me of that wonderful old novel by Richard Hughes called High Wind in Jamaica. But it was really high wind in Chalk Valley. It was an extraordinary time. Well, my subject is not a terribly cheerful one, but an important one. I'm not sure if you can see this, but it's the famous Dürer etching of the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And from left to right are death, famine, war, and plague. Those great catastrophes in human history have shaped so much of what has happened. They have often determined the course of events. They have brought revolutions sometimes. They have helped to overturn governments. They have left an imprint. We just have to ask ourselves what might have happened if the Axis powers had won in the Second World War. What sort of world would we be living in? What sort of world would we be living in if the Ottomans had conquered the heart of Europe, as they came so close to doing in the 16th and 17th centuries? We would, I think, be living in a different world. War is one of the great catastrophes that hits humanity, but I think very important to try and understand what it's about and how it has shaped us. And that's why we gave, after a good deal of transatlantic debate about what my book should be called, we called it How Conflict Shaped Us. What I tried to bring out in my book, and what I want to stress, I think, is that deep interrelationship between human society and war. I think too often we tend to think of war as something that's an aberration, that peace is the normal human condition, and war is something that happens and should best be forgotten as quickly as possible. And I think we shouldn't forget it, not only because to understand how war has influenced the past and has influenced the development of our human societies is to understand more about ourselves, but I also believe very strongly if we don't understand about it, we don't have much chance of noticing when it's about to happen again, and we don't have much chance of trying to stop it. And so I think it is something that must be taken very seriously indeed. And I think what is important is that two-way relationship between war and society. War is not something that happens out there, and I think we all know that, and of course you who are here at Chalk Valley know well how much war has affected the structures of society, has affected the positions of different groups in society, and that I think is something that is enormously important. But what has also worked the other way around is that societies have affected war. They have affected the sorts of wars we fight. Different societies fight very different sorts of war. Wars in which a small class, perhaps landowning, perhaps capitalist, dominates the means of production, dominates societies, tend to fight different sorts of wars. The wars tend to be fought by the elites or by those who are impressed to fight into war. But in hierarchical, highly structured hierarchical societies, we don't have what we have seen in the two great wars, that sense of a people fighting. War has been regarded as something that only certain parts of society do, and others suffer what they must. As societies have changed, that has also affected the ways in which wars themselves have changed. And so as certain societies became more democratic, as people expected to participate more in their own governments and in the shape of their own societies, then they were conversely expected to be prepared to defend those societies. And so war was something that brought people in to conflict as much as it helped to destroy them. And I think that relationship, again, is something that goes very deep. And I think we all know this in a way. If you go around London, so many of the places in London are called after great victories. Trafalgar Square, Waterloo Station, or in Paris, the Gare d'Austerlitz. These are visible imprints of what war has done for our societies. War has left its mark even in our language. Now, if you want to say something rude about someone else in English, you often use the word French. You talk about taking French leave, which is leaving very rudely. And the French have a phrase, filer à l'anglaise, which means leaving very rudely. So it does, I think, even in the sort of language we use, and of course so many expressions, particularly here in Britain, come from naval warfare. Having a square meal, putting a shot across someone's bows, striking your flag. A lot of these come out of the long history of naval war. War has also affected the growth of our institutions and indeed affected the growth of strong government. This is Whitehall, which of course is familiar, I'm sure, to most of you, and it was the War Office until 1858. The growth of strong central governments in a lot of European history was very much fueled by war. Governments needed to be able to extract the resources of their societies if they were to fight wars successfully or if they were to survive. And to do that, they needed to know what those resources were. And so the origin of the census in many countries, as it was in the Roman Empire, was to find out how many people you had available to fight. The growth of taxing powers was largely driven in many societies by the need to get the resources you needed. The growth of big bureaucracies was also driven by the need to manage those resources. I mean, the British Navy, which was the world's most powerful navy in the 18th and 19th centuries, took up a huge amount of the national wealth. And to manage that, to make sure it was being spent properly, to make sure that the ropes didn't break, to make sure that the pitch was there for the timbers, to make sure that the ammunition was there, to make sure that the sailors were trained properly, to make sure that officers knew what they were doing so they didn't take their boats out and sink them immediately, you needed a tremendous amount of organization. And again, it's that two-way relationship, because the more organized you got and the better you got at managing your resources for war, of course, the more you could use them to extend your power. And so great empires and great societies, great countries were built through war, some more than others perhaps. But if you look through the history of most countries, war has played a very important part in their growth to power and in maintaining that power. The Roman Empire was built because the Roman legions were superior to those they came into contact with. And it was maintained through force. It was maintained through other things. It was maintained through shared values, at least among elites. It was maintained by the fact that people wanted to live under the stable rule that the Roman Empire provided. People were moving into the Roman Empire and not out, which tells you something about it. But at base, what maintained the Roman Empire was force, was the capacity to exert force both on those in your own populations who might be rebelling, but also to keep your borders safe and exert force against those who would invade you. And so the growth of strong central government and at the same time the growth of strong states has been very much tied up with the needs of war. We have, I think, throughout history, had very ambivalent feelings towards this process, towards the importance that war has played in the development of our political and social and institutions and in the development of our cultural values. And I think our attitudes are very ambivalent, and I think we see this in our arts, we see it in our reactions to war. On the one hand, I think we still find something glorious in war. This is the famous David painting. He did several, but this is one of them, of Napoleon crossing the Alps on his way down into Italy at the end of the 1790s. Really a very important moment in his career when he made his mark as an extraordinary general. He didn't actually cross the Alps like this. Like a lot of good pieces of propaganda, it took liberties with the truth. He actually rode on a mule and was rather uncomfortable and didn't look like this. But this painting was enormously important, and I think it says something about our ambivalence about war. I mean, I think we are attracted, I certainly am, by the glory of war, by the courage of war, by the drama of war, by the great deeds that are done in war. But there's the other reaction, which we also have, These, I hope you can see, this is one of the set of Goya's The Disasters of War, which he didn't publish until after he had died, because I think they were so deeply critical of war and showed the horrors of war so deeply. This is from the time of the invasion by the Napoleonic forces of Spain, and this was, of course, the origins of the word guerrilla, for guerrilla war, when the Spanish people took matters into their own hands and rose up, and ordinary citizens fought, including women. And what this one shows is women, one woman holding a baby on her hip, running through a French soldier. And there's a whole series, which some of you have probably seen. What I think the Goya also does is remind us of something that gets forgotten too often in war, when we think of the great battles, the great clash of armies, the great triumphs, the great victories. What we think we often forget is what war can mean to civilians, to those who are its unwitting targets, those who are caught up in it. And I think we don't stress perhaps enough when we think about war, what it can actually mean to ordinary people, to people who through no choice of their own find themselves on a battlefield or find themselves in the way of war. The price paid by civilians for war is hideous indeed. And throughout the history of war, organized groups, whether states, baronies, tribes, have used attacks on the civilians of the others as a way of weakening their will to resist, have used the civilians on the other side as prizes of war. Women, children have been carried off, sometimes men, to be made into slaves or to be put into someone's household. And civilians have often, I think, been the forgotten part of war. We perhaps concentrate too much on those moments of high drama. There's a lot of debate among historians and anthropologists and archaeologists about how far war goes back into human society. And it's not a question, I think, that I can answer, but it has lasted a very long time. As far as we can tell, and it gets, of course, more difficult to be sure the further back we go into history, but as far as we can tell, as soon as we began to organize ourselves, whether it was into extended families, whether it was into clans, whether it was into tribes, and then when it became proto-states and then real states, as far back as we can tell, we were organizing ourselves to fight each other. And I define war, I should say, in a very particular way, not a random act of violence, not someone getting into a fight with someone else outside a pub or on a football field. That's not war. War is highly organized. War is using the resources that you have. It's manipulating or inspiring or ordering the people that you have to fight. It is making sure they have the weapons they want. It's making sure they have the equipment they need. All of that takes a tremendous amount of organization. And of course, in modern war, more organization than ever before. It's now estimated that most modern armed forces have about 10 people or more in support of every single person who's actually combatant, because the tail, as they call it, to actually maintain people in the field is now so enormous. But the evidence seems to be that war is almost synchronous with human organization. And so very early graves have been found of peoples, possibly hunter foragers, but certainly agriculturalists when people began to settle down and become agriculturalists. Bodies have been found in mass graves sometimes, which bear the marks of trauma, which look as if they were killed deliberately, which bear the skeletons bear wounds that look like the sort of wounds you would get even today in combat. And so as far as we know, war is something that has run in a very dark way through human history, and of course still runs through human history today. We, most of us, have been very lucky because we have lived since 1945 in what a lot of people now call the Long Peace. If you've grown up in a country like mine, Canada, you haven't seen a war, you haven't really felt the effects of war. Some Canadians have fought, but they've fought on the other side of the world. It's not something that has affected most Canadians. But I think we should remember that even though a lot of us have enjoyed the long peace, a lot of the world hasn't, and a lot of the world is not. Since 1945, it's been estimated there's been a war every year somewhere or other in the world. And there are wars now, of course. There is a war going on in Ethiopia. There is still a war, and looks like it will persist going on in Afghanistan. And there are threats of war elsewhere. We don't know what's going to happen, for example, over Taiwan. We don't know what's going to happen on the high Himalayan frontiers between India and China, where troops from both countries have been fighting recently. And so war is not something that's gone away, even though some of us have been very lucky to live in a world that hasn't seen much war. And in some ways, but not all, in some ways, war has persisted in a very similar pattern. These are Assyrian soldiers fighting centuries before the birth of Christ, an early depiction of war. They, of course, helped to build the great Assyrian Empire. And these are American GIs fighting in Korea in the war between 1950 and 1953. And in some ways, they have different weapons, but what they're doing in combat is not that different from what the Assyrians were doing all those centuries ago. One of the other great debates, apart from when did war start and how far back does it go, is why do we do it? And there's a spectrum of opinions. One is that we're programmed to do it, that evolution has left us with a lot of things. It's left us with hands that we can use to make tools, but it's also left us with deeply aggressive tendencies, so that we fight because there is something in our natures that makes us want to fight. And the other extreme is that no, we are not programmed to do anything, because if you look at human beings, we also have instincts of altruism, instincts of cooperation, and we can see those persisting through history as well. We fight because of culture. We fight because we are convinced, or we are acculturated, or we're persuaded that war is a useful instrument. Those who lead us think, perhaps in some societies, that war can be used usefully to achieve the goals that they want. We fight because we consciously make the decision to fight. It's a long and very complicated debate, and I could go into a lot about monkeys, because monkeys are studied in great detail to see whether they're our closest cousins in nature, to see whether we can work out whether it's natural instinct or not. But I will just mention two of my favorite monkeys, the chimpanzees and the bonobo. The chimpanzees move, the males move in gangs. They will patrol the outskirts, the perimeters of where they live, and if a male from another band comes in, they will destroy it, or they'll do their best to destroy it. They'll do their best to kill it. They wage war on each other, and they will often raid each other's territories. But just across the Congo River live a group of monkeys that for a long time people thought were the chimpanzees, and they're actually the bonobos. And the bonobos don't fight. And if a stranger wanders in to a bonobo encampment, that stranger is greeted and made part of the group. Now, possibly, I'm just throwing this out, it may be because the bonobos are a matriarchy and the chimpanzees are a patriarchy, but I'll leave it to you to decide which explanation you like. But it seems to me the evidence really is not there to say that we fight because we're programmed to do it. Random acts of violence may be something evolution has left us with. We do lash out when we're afraid. We tend to get aggressive when we're afraid. But that doesn't explain war in its highly organized form. And so I've come down, I think, more on the side of culture. And you can certainly see certain cultures in history where martial values have been inculcated, where young men in particular have been brought up to think that the most noble thing they can do is fight and, if necessary, die. You think of Sparta in the ancient world, where young men from privileged families were taken away from their families, were trained in groups to build a group cohesion, and were expected to go and fight, and as I say, if necessary, die. And it was said, although there's now, of course, historians being what they are, we dispute everything, it's said that the Spartan mothers used to say to their sons, go to war carrying your shield. If you come back, you must be carried on it. We don't want the shame of you losing your shield. Now, as I say, this has been disputed, but it seems to me still a good story that shows something about the values of culture. Or take Prussia. Prussia, where the upper classes for generations expected that their young men would go into the military because that was the noblest profession of all. There used to be a joke about Prussia, that it was not a country that happened to have an army, it was an army that happened to have a country. And I think there's something in that. And we can see it, I think, more recently in the 19th century, in 19th century Britain, for example. I don't know how many of you read G.A. Henty books when you were young. He wrote a great many, I think 50 or 60. They had many different titles. This is Wolf the Saxon, but you've got With Clive in India, with Wolf at in Quebec. He took episodes from the past and told stories about war. The plots are almost identical. I mean, they're good reads, but the plots are always usually two boys, one from a rich family and one from a poor family. And the rich boy is spoilt and not a good fighter, and the poor boy is noble and works his way up and is a good fighter and eventually triumphs. They usually end on a happy note. And he once said that he wrote them deliberately, hoping to inculcate a spirit of war into the young men of England. And you will notice that he focused, as indeed so much of history focuses, on the men who fight. It is probably the case that 99.9% of those who have fought in history, in the past, in every society, have been male. And again, as you can imagine, there is a considerable debate about this. Is this because men are necessarily more violent and belligerent than women? And is it something to do with their genetic makeup? Is it something to do with the amount of testosterone they have? Are women the nurturers, the peacemakers? Are they somehow different from men? And you can imagine, particularly today, where gender is becoming more of a fluid issue and a much more contested issue, how controversial these debates are, how heated such debates can get. And it is certainly possible to find examples through history of women who have fought. We used to think that the Amazons were a figment of the Greeks' imagination, something they thought about as so horrific, the idea that women would fight, would act as warriors, would actually kill their male children because they didn't want male children around. This horrified the Greeks. We used to think it was simply stories that they told themselves to frighten themselves. But recently, archaeologists have found graves around the north shore of the Black Sea, for example, where you will find skeletons, and they can now, thanks to modern methods, they can now tell whether those skeletons are male or female. These are female skeletons, often buried with weapons. The remains of weapons are there, and again, often bearing the marks of trauma. And so it looks like, in fact, there really were women in the classical world who did fight, who trained as fighters, who organized as fighters, and who fought as fighters. And of course, we know through history they've been the occasional women who've disguised themselves as soldiers, as men, gone off and fought, gone into the Navy. In the Second World War, a lot of Soviet women fought in combat roles. These women are called the Germans called them the Night Witches. They were Soviet bomber pilots and fighter pilots. And they struck particular horror into the Germans, who treated them extremely badly when they captured them. These women often carried pistols with them so they could shoot themselves before the Germans got hold of them. But certainly in the Soviet armies in the Second World War, women did occupy combat roles, not just as pilots, but they manned artillery batteries, they were snipers, they fought in guerrilla war. On the other hand, we have the view of women as peacemakers. This is one of the women's demonstrations outside Greenham Common, when the Americans, at the request of the British government, were deploying a new generation of weapons, including drones. And there was a massive protest, a women's protest, that went on, I forget for how many years, I mean, over a decade, I think. And it was only women. And this was a human chain that was found, that was formed around Greenham Common. And so that's the other side. Are women the peacemakers? Are women the ones who try and prevent war? Would it be so? A lot of women, it is true, have been involved in peace movements. A lot of the peace movements in the 19th century, in the 20th century, had women playing a very prominent part indeed. But I often get asked, wouldn't the world be a much more peaceful place if women ran it? And my short answer, I have a long answer, but my short answer is Golda Meir, Catherine the Great, Margaret Thatcher. These are not necessarily women who make the world a more peaceful place. And so I think, again, like the whole debate about is war our biological destiny or not, is something that goes on. And what I think we also have to remember is women have been the victims of war. Women are often the prizes in war, as I mentioned earlier. And there has been throughout history, and I think we're seeing it today in a particularly horrific form, the idea that women can be abused as a result of war. Rape has always been, I think, seen as a reward for soldiers in war, but it's increasingly becoming a weapon of war In Bosnia, for example, in the 1990s, Serb nationalist forces would rape Bosnian women, Muslim women, and say, you will now have to bear a Serb child. It was a deliberate attempt to destroy what they saw as an alien race within Bosnia. Women, too, have been cheerleaders of war. You know this poster. It's a very famous poster from the First World War. Women of Britain say go. And a lot of women of Britain and of Canada and of France and elsewhere did say go. And of course, you know the stories of the women with the white feathers. We had them in my country, Canada. You had them here in the UK. The women who handed out white feathers to young men of military age who were not in uniform and tried to shame them into going. And so the relationship of gender to war, I think, is a very complex one. I don't have any answers for it because I think it is largely a part of culture. But I think the view that men are naturally the fighters and women are naturally the peacemakers, when you look at it more closely, begins to dissolve a bit. One of the other fascinating questions about war is, why do changes come in it? Because, of course, we fight with what is available. And some of the great changes in war have been changing metals. When people fought with bronze weapons, they were not reliable, they broke easily. They then moved into making iron, and those weapons were more forceful, stronger, could kill more efficiently. And then, of course, steel could kill even more efficiently still. The horse was one of the things that changed war a lot. Early wars were fought, certainly in the West, largely on foot. And then the horse arrived from Central Asia. It could pull chariots and it could pull warriors. And so war became highly mobile. Those on horse for some time, and it is a cycle that's repeated itself through history, happened again in the Middle Ages when you got knights on horseback. Those on horse could overwhelm and destroy those on the ground. But gradually people learnt how to deal with that. They learnt how to stand firm when the horses charged. They learned to form, as the Romans often did, something with spears sticking outwards, and so the horses would impale themselves. And they learned again in the Middle Ages with foot soldiers and with those with bows. And so it's always been a back and forth in war between a new technology, a new device, a new type of weapon, and then finding ways to use it, because the military don't always like new weapons. It's a nuisance. You have to change, and you have to change your training, and you have to change what you do. There's a story that at the beginning of the First World War, a British officer in charge of a regiment was issued with machine guns, and he looked and he said, take those disgraceful things to the back and lose them somewhere. Because changing your ways of fighting, getting used to a new technology, can be very difficult. But if you don't get used to it, then of course you will be overwhelmed by those who are in fact better than you at using it. And so the horse did make a huge difference in war. And then of course, so did gunpowder. If you've seen medieval castles, they have tall and graceful walls, and those were perfect for preventing people from getting into the castle, from climbing into the castle. The taller the wall, in effect, the better. But those walls were highly vulnerable to cannon shots. And so if you look at the castles and fortresses of the 17th, 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, they're much lower and the walls are much thicker. The gunpowder revolution made a huge change to war. It made possible sieges. It made possible the destruction of a lot of those people who dominated their societies because they possessed the castles. One of the ways in which the state, the central state, began to grow was when the monarchs in Europe began to create their own armed forces, their own cannon. They destroyed one by one the remaining feudal, independent baronies, states, whatever they were, inside them. And so gunpowder was, in the hands of those who knew how to use it, a tremendous asset. And then, of course, it spread into the sort of weapons that ordinary soldiers on foot used. Now, this is a very early type of infantry weapon. It wasn't reliable. It wasn't very accurate. It often exploded in your hands. But it was the beginning of a much more efficient way of killing. And, of course, that technological revolution was going to go on. And I think if we look back at the 17th, 18th, and 19th, and 20th centuries, we see that technology has speeded up. The speed of the advance in war, in the technology, has been enormous. And I'll just give you one example from the 19th century. At the beginning of the 19th century, there had been certain advances in the standard infantry weapon. The standard infantry weapon in the Napoleonic Wars was still a musket, and it was still largely smoothbore, although there was some rifling, which made them more accurate and made it possible to project the bullet further, the shot further. But they still were not terribly accurate. Beyond about 100 yards away, you couldn't be sure of hitting anyone. You probably know that famous expression, don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes. And that actually meant something. If you fired too soon, you would then be caught reloading. And reloading was a very cumbersome business, and you had to do it standing up. And so you made a very nice target for anyone who hadn't yet fired. And so it took tremendous discipline to keep the soldiers from firing. And they could only really kill each other from, as I say, about 100 yards away. By the end of the 19th century, they could kill each other from 1,000 yards away or more. And the weapons they had now often were repeating rifles. The machine gun had become, in spite of the British officers, standard equipment in most of the big European armies. And it was possible now to kill from a much greater distance. And you could reload lying down, which meant that you were much, much safer as you actually lay there getting your weapon ready. And of course, it wasn't only the infantry weapons, it was the artillery. Artillery becomes much further, can fire much further. The big Bertha guns could hit targets 60 miles away in the First World War. Naval war became extraordinary because you were often firing at ships you never saw at all because they were over the horizon. And that speed in technology, the changing nature of war, the nature of the technology available, I think has speeded up and is still speeding up. This will just give you one example, of course, what we reached at the end of the Second World War, the use of nuclear weapons. To that date, the most devastating bomb ever. This was the bomb dropped on Hiroshima, and there was one dropped, as you know, on Nagasaki. They haven't been used since, and we have to hope they won't, because the power in the bombs being made today is many times more powerful than the ones that were dropped on either Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What also happened to war in the modern world, as the pace of change speeded up in technology, was war, of course, was getting more deadly. We were getting a lot more efficient at killing each other, but we were also getting a lot more organized in how we did it, and war was getting bigger. A number of things came together in the 19th century to make war possible on a mass industrial scale. And of course, one of these is the Industrial Revolution. This is an example of one of the early plants, a production line where it was possible to produce standard weapons, one after the other, whereas it had taken a gunsmith weeks to produce a good gun, you could now turn out weapons on assembly lines. It became possible, therefore, to equip a lot more people. It also became possible to move a lot more people because, thanks again to the Industrial Revolution and the scientific and technological revolutions that went on with it, it became possible to move vast numbers of people by railways or by steamship, and eventually, of course, by the internal combustion engine. You not only could equip a lot of people, you could not only move a lot of people, you could keep them there, which is one of the reasons the First World War turned into a stalemate, because the industrial capacity of Europe to maintain a war was used, really, in a sense, to destroy Europe. Europe turned on itself, and its industrial capacity made possible that dreadful stalemate. And just again, to give you an idea of the shift in numbers, Napoleon took an army into Russia in 1812, possibly of 600,000. It was too big for what he was trying to do. He couldn't feed it. Probably more of his soldiers died of starvation and disease and froze to death than died in combat. It was beyond the capacity of Napoleon to supply, and the soldiers could not live off the land in a Russia where the Russian government had adopted a scorched earth policy. In the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, the German Confederation mobilized something like 1.5 million troops and got them to the French border. It gives you a sense. In this case, they managed to support them, and they managed to supply them, and they managed to move them. And then in the First World War, in the opening stages of the First World War, the Germans mobilized and moved 3 million soldiers. So from 600,000 in 1812, 1914, 3 million just on one side alone. It gives you an idea of just how big war was getting. In fact, we had to think of new words for it. We had to think of words like total war and world war. just an example of the ways in which people were being moved around. Of course, you had to have the railways in the right place, and they weren't always going to the right place, but it does make a huge difference. The other thing that happened, certainly in Europe, where a lot of innovations in war seem to have happened in the modern age, the other thing that happened is that people were more prepared to make the sacrifices in a large-scale war. This is a very early picture from the French Revolution, the Battle of Valmy in 1793, when forces hostile, the Austrian Empire leading them, forces hostile for the French Revolution attempted to invade France. And they came, traditional 18th century armies, highly rigidly disciplined and very well organized, and they found themselves facing a ragtag bunch of French revolutionary soldiers who rushed across the battlefields, not in any formation in particular, who sang revolutionary songs, who seemed prepared to die in ways that these traditional soldiers thought was absolutely absurd. One officer who had witnessed this onslaught said it was like dealing with wild beasts. They didn't know how to fight properly. The forces against the French Revolution withdrew. They couldn't cope with it. And so the spirit of nationalism, that sense that you are fighting and dying for a cause, was something that was going to motivate all those millions of people who fought in the wars of Italian unification and German unification in the 19th century, and was going to motivate those from around the world who fought in the two great world wars. And so we got total war. This is a picture from the Vienna War Museum of soldiers trying to attack over ground, and you can see what war had become. They look like, to me, cogs in a machine. They're bent double into the storm of fire that's coming towards them. And so war, although people longed in the First and Second World Wars for glorious deeds, war had become something on a mass scale, deeply destructive. Now, yet another, and war is full of these paradoxes, but another thing we wonder about is, can war ever be good for us? Not in the sense, although there were those who talked about this before the First World War, about how every nation needs a good, healthy tonic of war. There was quite a famous professor of war at Oxford who said every nation needs its young men to go out and fight and be prepared to die. A good, healthy bloodletting, I think, was the way he put it. I hate to be unkind, but I think he was past military age at that point. But beyond that, does war do anything that is actually beneficial? And again, it's very difficult to say, but in fact it does. Things are possible in war that are not possible in peacetime. It is possible to spend money on a scale in a war if you're fighting for your very existence that it wouldn't be in peacetime. And we've seen this, I think, in the recent pandemic. Things that if we had said a year and a half ago, governments would be spending money freely to invest in the development of vaccines, to build factories, to support the economy, we would have said, no, they'll never do it. It's ridiculous. It's too extravagant. This is what war will do, particularly if it is a war for ultimate survival. And so, yes, things do come out of war. I don't know if you can read this. It's probably too faint. But this is a plaque very near where I live in Oxford, which commemorates the first successful use of penicillin as a treatment in 1941, which saved the life of a patient. Now, it had been discovered how to make penicillin between the wars, but nobody wanted to produce it. It was simply too expensive. Suddenly, when the war started, it was no longer too expensive. And so a drug that has saved probably millions of lives was produced as a result of war. What we've also seen as a result of war is changes in the position of classes, changes in the position of women. This is a woman working in a factory making explosives in the First World War. A job that it would have been said couldn't be done by a woman. And we know that in the First and Second World Wars, women in this country and other countries filled jobs which no one had ever thought they could do. Perhaps they thought they could do it, but in a male-dominated society, it was thought that women couldn't do certain jobs. They were too rough, too dangerous, they didn't have the capacity to do them. And as a result of this, the position of women and the working class in a number of societies was going to change. Again, it's probably too small to see, but this is a medal that was struck for the Representation of People Act in 1918, passed by the British Parliament before the First World War was over, and it was passed in recognition that the vote should be given to women, only to women over 30. It was felt that women under 30 were still a bit too flighty to know what to do with the vote, but it also gave, the Representation of People Act also gave the vote to all men over the age of 21, which meant that men in the working class who hadn't got the property which they needed. You needed a property qualification to vote before the First World War, could now vote. And so social change has often been pushed faster, sometimes to more extremes, during war as a result of war. The welfare state was set up by the British government after the Second World War very much in recognition of the contribution made by all parts of society. In the Beveridge Report, which really provided the foundation for it, he said, Lord Beveridge said, we have to recognize the sacrifices that the people of Britain have made. And you often, I think, get greater social equality as a result of war. It's been argued that the two world wars, in fact, compressed the differences in society. The rich had to pay more taxes, the poor got better paid. And we have had the greatest periods of equality in Western societies as a result of two wars. I'm not saying we should go to war to get these things, but I think we need to remember that war can bring beneficial changes as well as dreadful ones. Finally, we continue to remember it. This is one of the most moving monuments from the First World War, done by the German sculptress Katy Kollwitz, whose son joined up full of enthusiasm to help Germany in 1914. In August 1914, he was dead by November. And she's made this sculpture, and it's herself and her husband, and they're apart, they're both mourning, they are shattered by the loss of their son. But we still have the other side. We have the horror of war and the appalling nature of war here, but we still also get this. And so I'm going to conclude with this. It's a big military parade in Beijing. It could be in a number of countries. It's not just China that has such parades. President Trump had his own great military parade in Washington. There are big military parades in France, big military parades in Russia. There are still states who think that war can be used, and I think still people who admire war and see its glamour. And so I leave you with this old question, which is not going to go away. Can we get rid of it? Is it part of our lives? Is it part of our societies? I just don't know. Thank you. There are two people rushing around with microphones, so if you have a question, or lots of microphones anyway, so if you would like to ask a question, I'd be happy to answer. I think this is a lady just over there.
Thank you. Just to amplify your point about there having been a war since every year since 1945, I believe all except two individual years, a British soldier has died in conflict since the end of the Second World War. But to go on, I mean, it's more or less your last point, but we as a society like to recognize the sacrifice made and made by veterans and those who've died, but how do we draw the line between recognizing a sacrifice and glorifying?
No, it's very difficult. How do we distinguish between recognizing and glorifying? And we don't always, do we? I think there was a lot of debate after the First World War about how to commemorate those who had died, and of course in hideous numbers. And I think our attitudes also change. When the body of the unknown soldier was brought back from France in, I think it was 1920, he was described, and it was a he was described as a dead hero. And people believed that he had sacrificed his life for something good, and then the doubts crept in, as they often do as time goes by, and people began to see the unknown soldier as someone who had died in a futile war and who as symbolic of all those lives that had been lost in a futile way. And I think we veer in societies between that, and it's very hard to get it right, and I think it depends very much on the nature of the society. What I think there's always a difference is between what governments would like us to believe and what we do ourselves. You know, I think in Russia, for example, Putin has been very conscious of the need and to promote a view of war as glorious, of Russia as a great power. He takes a deep interest in the school curriculum and they've built an enormous cathedral, which is made partly out of captured German war material to the dead of the Second World War. And so I think it depends on who's doing the commemorating. I think often people will commemorate their dead in a different way than governments might want to use that commemoration. But it changes. And I think what's changed in Western societies is we are no longer collectively prepared to see large numbers of our young people die in war. And I think if you look, I'm always forgetting the number, but the number of British soldiers who died in Afghanistan is under 1,000. 20,000 died on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, and yet people persisted in the First World War. I think that is unthinkable today. I think, you know, certainly societies in Western Europe, I think it's true of the United States and Canada and other societies around the world, simply wouldn't accept that degree of death anymore.
Hello, good evening. Do the laws of war prolong them?
Oh, that is, well, you've hit on yet another of the many debates about war. I don't think they do, but it is something that is, it's such a complicated subject. We think of war as, it is an act of violence, an act of controlled violence, and so it seems extraordinary we'd even have laws about it, but we do. And I think it is part of a human attempt to try and get rid of war, or at least control it so that its effects are not as dreadful as possible. And we continue, I think, to hope that we can live in a world without war. I mean, it is something we continue to hope for, and making laws about war seem at least a partial step towards that. I don't think that they prolong war. I think what prolongs war is the determination of both sides to fight on. And what tends to happen in a war, particularly in total wars, wars which engage societies and in which one society sees another society as an existential threat, as you know, not just the enemy soldiers, but the enemy people as deserving to be destroyed, the laws of wars tend to get ignored and neglected. On the Eastern Front in the Second World War, there was very little attention paid by either side to the laws of war, which made it, you know, even more dreadful. But I don't think the laws in themselves prolong the war. I think there's someone on that side. Yeah. Well, I think Western Europe has enjoyed, one of its longest periods of peace in history. I mean, it has been a really bloody continent, and there's been major wars pretty much every century, as far back as we can see. There is a very interesting book by someone called Sheehan, I can't remember his first name, called Where Have All the Soldiers Gone? And he argues there's been a huge cultural shift in Western Europe, and people are no longer prepared to fight. And the wars that a number of countries did fight in Western Europe to try and hang on to empires were deeply unpopular. And the French had to pull out of Indochina because the French public was no longer prepared to support it. And so I think Western Europe has moved a long way. And the culture of societies in Western Europe is not particularly sympathetic to war. I mean, we don't get schools saying to young people, you must be a brave little soldier or a brave little naval sailor or whatever. These are not things that we would approve of in our schools anymore, although that certainly happened in the 19th and early 20th centuries. So I think Europe has moved, but you never know, because you never know what will persuade people they really do need to fight. In the United States, isolationism was extremely strong sentiment before 1939, and Roosevelt more or less was reelected on a platform of keeping the United States out of the war. And if you'd done a poll, the Gallup polls were just beginning, majority of Americans didn't want to get involved in another war, and then Pearl Harbor happened, and a majority of Americans changed their minds overnight. And so I don't think any cultural changes are permanent, and it depends what you're up against. Perhaps up at the front here.
Thank you very much, Mother. I don't want our troops to leave Afghanistan. I know why we're leaving or why we're going to leave, but morally, for the young girls' education, I'm a big Malala supporter, so I'm worried about the young girls in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Well,
I just don't think we should leave.
Yeah, I don't know if you could all hear that question, but what's going to happen to, well, not just the young women of Afghanistan, what's going to happen to the ordinary civilians of Afghanistan if the West leaves? But we've done no good there, have we? We've been there, and I can say we because Canadians have been there. I think we've been there for 20 years, and the country is as divided, perhaps more divided than ever. The levels of brutality, the levels of casual brutality, but also deliberate brutality, blowing up hospital wards with babies in them, targeting girls' schools because they represent a minority strand in Islam, This is a brutalized society, and I think we've contributed unwittingly and perhaps with all sorts of good motives to that brutalization, and I'm not sure what good we can do there. And again, it's, you know, in democratic countries, it has to be supported by the public, and I think the publics don't want any further war and any further contributions to what's going on in Afghanistan. I share your horror at what is likely to happen, but I don't see how it can be prevented, certainly not by people coming from halfway around the world who don't really understand the society and are not prepared to put force in any meaningful way. You know, I think every country involved there now would like to get out, so, including the U.S. So I think perhaps at the very back there.
Could I ask what your feeling is about the way wars are now being developed through zones, through drones flying around that have been programmed?
I think it's a very worrying development. I mean, war was already, thanks to the development of long-range guns and artillery, already becoming more distant. I mean, most of the soldiers killed in the First World War were killed by artillery, fired by people who never saw them. You know, that not that many people were killed by hand-to-hand combat using knives or bayonets. And I think the question is it easier to kill someone if you can't see them? And if you have someone sitting in, say, Arizona or New Mexico, directing a drone to a target in Afghanistan, does that person sitting there with what really is like a console for a war game, does that person actually feel any sense that they are destroying people? Now, I've been told that they do, and that they often have to have a lot of support because it is emotionally and psychologically very difficult. And they can sometimes see with cameras the results of what they've actually done. And as we know, they sometimes get the wrong targets, which does happen in war. And I think it is a danger, however. And I think we're also, what's really worrying me about war is we're moving more and more into the use of artificial intelligence, autonomous weapon systems that will guide themselves and make decisions. You know, the next generation of fighter planes don't need pilots. You know, as human beings, we're too slow and we react too slowly. I mean, there's now talk of altering the pilots and putting chips in their brains and helping them to stay awake for 24 hours. I mean, the possibilities are horrific. And what concerns me more and more is that if war becomes something you simply press a button or you simply set in motion something which you then can't control, where is the sense of responsibility and where is the shame that you might feel for doing something awful? Now, I think we're on the edge of yet another of those great leaps that you get in war with the introduction of the horse, with the introduction of gunpowder, with the introduction of the atomic bomb. We're now getting another of those leaps with autonomous weapon systems, artificial intelligence, and then, of course, there's the whole weaponization of space. You know, we've got more and more weapons now in space and more people talking about how space will be used to fight a war. So, no, I find it very worrying indeed. Oh, sorry, over there. Yeah.
Suicide bombers and suicide missions, the other side, face of this impersonalization of war on the one hand, and then this intense personalization as a provocative gesture.
Yes.
How does that fit in?
Yeah. No, that's an absolutely fascinating question. I don't know if you could all hear it, because we've got the depersonalization of war and the high-tech war, but then we've got this highly personalized thing where you get people strapping explosives to themselves and killing themselves and doing so for a cause. And I think what we're seeing in some ways is war on two levels. We're seeing a development of this extraordinary high-tech war, and war in not just in space but in cyberspace, which is another sort of new battlefield that's opening up. But we're also seeing war that in some ways is very similar to wars fought in the past. People prepared to die for a cause. And in the 19th century and 20th centuries, it was often nationalism. Today, it seems to be religion, although nationalism, I think, still comes into it. And I think we're also seeing wars fought in ways that would be very familiar to those Assyrian soldiers. I mean, a lot of the wars fought in Africa. I mean, recently in Mozambique, there was a terrible war or action in the north, and people were fighting with machetes and hoes. You know, that we are seeing war being fought on a number of different planes, some very expensive and some very high tech, but some highly personal. And one of the things the military are worrying about a lot now is urban war, because we're more and more moving into big urban agglomerations. And we're already seeing what's happening. I mean, there are parts of, I don't know if you saw the news story, but Rio, which had become ungovernable in the favelas, which were being run by gangs, and the Rio police came in as if in a military action with tanks, armored vehicles, and broke their way in. So yeah, I think we're going to see, we're going to see both levels of war, and they will intersect at some point. But I think we have to expect, and of course, in a way, the terrorist action is the action of a weaker enemy. They use terrorism because they don't have anything else to use, but it's a way of striking horror into the enemy. September the 11th is something I think that still defines Americans. They still talk about it. You know, it is something that they still, and we remember, I think, in any country, we remember the horrific terrorist actions. They don't destroy the governments, they don't overthrow our societies, but they leave an imprint nevertheless, and it may make us more reluctant to get involved in places like Afghanistan in future. So, no, it's very complicated, I think. I don't know if you want me to stop. Yeah. One last question. Okay, there's a hand here. You were very quick, I think, in getting.
You haven't talked about civil wars.
Yeah.
Civil wars. We've had Yugoslavia, we did nothing. We've had Syria, we've done nothing. Afghanistan, arguably, we've done very little.
Yeah.
How do we deal with those in the future?
Yeah. Well, civil wars, I think, are almost the most difficult to deal with because they are so passionate. And they are so much one society against another, engaging all levels of society. And it's like a family fight. You know, it's you know each other so well. And it's when the ties of affection that have bound you begin to turn to hate, and you can't forgive the other side because they're busting up the family, or they're trying to claim all the family silver and you want to share the family silver. And so civil wars, I think, are among the most vicious. And it's true in modern war generally, all targets are permissible. You know, that if you're fighting an enemy who's producing lots of weapons to fight you, then you'll try and destroy the enemy's factories and the enemy's civilians, which is, of course, what happened in the First and Second World Wars and happens today. But in a civil war, you want to destroy the other side utterly. General Sherman said, I want to make the women and children of the South feel that they do not want to fight on. As one of his generals said, I want to leave them with nothing but their eyes to weep with. There was a deliberate attempt. And I think undoing the effects of civil wars, as we know, are very difficult because the hatreds will linger on. And we see this. I mean, I think, I hate to say it, but I think we're seeing it in Northern Ireland. You know, the tensions there are rising again, partly as a result of Brexit and the protocol. And the memories are there, and they don't go away. I mean, that's, I think, what helped to break up Yugoslavia. Those memories had been there since 1945, but they'd gone underground. They don't go away. Now, I think civil wars are all wars are dreadful, but civil wars, I think, are fought with a particular passion and hatred. That's a dreadful note to end on, but sorry.